Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that we've got Brother Rick here who's got 4 days in a row. Is there anybody with less than that here? Anybody in their first 30 days? All right, welcome. Welcome. That's good. Just so I know what we're dealing with, how many people are in their first year? All right, excellent. Good deal. And how many of you have not been to a retreat before? Oh, very good. Quite a few people. All right. Well, just so you have a little bit more detail before I go into my story, tomorrow morning when we start at 9 o'clock, the first session is going to be on retreat. So we're going to talk about what a retreat is, at least from my perspective, and we're going to have a meditation. The second session is going to be on inventory. The third session is going to be on forgiveness and amends. And what I'd like to do is I'm going to, throughout the time period, over the next half a day or so, I'm going to pick 2 to 4 of you, and I'm going to ask you towards the end of the session to tell a personal story of 3 to 5 minutes of an amends. Because from my perspective, amends are very critical, they're very important, number one. Number two, while many of you know each other, you probably don't know each other at that intimate level. And something happens when someone tells an amends story that congeals the group and brings the group together. We'll have lunch, and then afterwards, as Dale said, we're going to have a session where we're going to have questions and answer. Hopefully, you'll put questions in a basket, I'll read them, and I'll do my best to answer them. That evening, we're going to have a regular AA meeting that's going to be led by Dale, and although he said I can be here, can't I, Dale? Okay. I promise I won't talk, but I just want to be here, okay? And then the next morning, we're going to have 2 sessions, and those sessions will depend on what happens, really, on Saturday. But essentially, they deal with a couple things that I think are more spiritual in nature, okay? And the last session is called All Is Well, and I think you'll understand that once we get to that. And I really want to encourage you to do the meditation. I've been to this group a number of times. The meditation is fantastic. One of the things that I want you guys to consider, and I want to just take a moment here, I'm going to ask you to just give me a minute, where I'm going to ask you to shut your eyes and get quiet and just visualize leaving all the problems that you had or you think you had at the bottom of the hill as you came up here. So we're just going to have a moment, 1 minute of silence starting now. All right, gentlemen, welcome to your retreat. My name is Steve Lamb, and I'm an alcoholic. Again, it's good to be here. It's good to be sober. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I talk a bit around, but I really enjoy retreats. I go to several a year, and I usually lead a few a year, and they're much more impactful for me than going to a conference, convention, or roundup, because there's a level of intimacy at a retreat that you don't get at those types of functions. And if you're new, we'll talk about it a little bit more tomorrow morning, but you're probably thinking, what is this retreat? You know, what's going on? This is your retreat, okay? Sometimes they'll call me the retreat leader or the retreat master, which is a little bit facetious in my view. I like to think of myself more as a coordinator, okay, as a facilitator, because we're here for you to have an experience. Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. I've had my experience primarily through the steps. You're here to have your experience. And tonight, basically, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story just so you understand who you'll be dealing with this particular weekend. My sobriety date is July 27th, 1996. So I've got 21 years and some change. And the first thing I want to tell you is I'm really grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be anywhere. The reason why I say that is because I almost didn't make it to 20 years. Now, it wasn't that I was thinking about drinking or I got close to drinking. What happened was I got shot. Now, I was in the Army for 13 and a half years. I've been shot before, but this particular time I got shot in the chest. And when I got shot before, it was a flesh wound. It was in the leg. It was an extremity. It wasn't a good thing, but this was much more significant. It was May 22nd of 2016. I was up in Badger, California, at a place called the Seven Circles Retreat Center. And I was minding my own business. Really, I was. We just had breakfast. I was in my bunk. I was sitting on my bunk, and I think I was getting ready to meditate. And what happened was the gentleman that was upstairs from me decided to clear his Glock 9mm weapon. And he missed a critical step. And he discharged a round, and he went through the bed that was he was sitting on and through the floor that was on him. And then that was the ceiling above me, and it entered my chest right above my heart and traveled down and parked right underneath my sternum. It's still there. Now, I'll tell you, that'll get your attention, okay? And we talk about serenity and we talk about spirituality a lot, but, you know, frankly, the first word out of my mouth was not very spiritual. It was a very shortened, abbreviated version of fire truck. And I pretty much yelped it. And the guy from upstairs, he comes running downstairs, and he's like, "Man, what happened?" I'm like, "Dude, you shot me. That's what happened, you know?" And he's all freaking out. He's all freaking out. And I got to tell you, 20 years and some change before that, it wouldn't have happened the way it happened. The way it happened was I was concerned because he was freaking out. Now, I checked. I didn't have an exit wound. I put my finger in the entry wound, which sounds a little odd, but you're trying to find the round, and I couldn't find the round, but I wasn't bleeding out, obviously. I didn't have a sucking chest wound, and, you know, it was serious, but I didn't think I was going to die at least immediately, so I was concerned about him because he's freaking out. I'm telling him it's going to be okay. Calm down. I go in the bathroom. I get a towel. I put it over the wound. I tell him he's got to take me down to the hospital because we're in Badger. We got to get to Visalia. Visalia is normally about an hour down the road. We made it in about 35 minutes. This guy was driving like a bat out of hell. I remember at one point in time, I leaned over to him and I said, "Look, I really do not want to survive this gunshot wound and die in a car wreck. So if you could just take it down a notch, I would really appreciate it." We get to the emergency room. I walk in the emergency room. They always ask you if they can help you. I said, "Yes, you can." They said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I've been shot." Now, when you tell them that you've been shot, you go right to the head of the line. You know, the waiting room is full. They got some broken bones. Some people are sniffling. But they put me on a gurney. They got 14, 15 people working on me. They take an x-ray. They find the round lodged underneath my sternum. They realize that it hasn't hit any major arteries, hasn't hit my heart. And it looks like I'm going to survive this. So now I'm the freak show. Everybody wants to come by because it's just weird. You know, I have the x-ray. I'll show you if you're interested later on during the week. But it's weird. I got this round. It's just parked underneath my sternum. And so they take me up to the cardiothoracic intensive care unit, and I have a cardiologist who has noted that when they did an EKG on me that I have this thing called an atrial flutter. Now, an atrial flutter is kind of like atrial fibrillation, but apparently it's not quite as serious. And what it means is that your heart is just spasming, which is not that shocking since I've been just shot. You know, I would imagine it wasn't too happy with that circumstance. And the cardiologist at Cahuilla Medical Center tells me, "Look, when you go back down south to your home, you're going to have to check in with your cardiologist, and he'll run another EKG because this atrial flutter, you got to look into this." So I go down, I see Dr. Carlson. He does an EKG, says, "You got this atrial flutter," but he tells me, "Look, Lamb, we've got a procedure for this. This is not that big a deal, and we've got a procedure, and I think it'll work for you." And now, you've seen in the movies where they take, you know, they paddle a guy and they shock a guy. That's not what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're going to tape these pads to your chest, and then we're going to shock you, and that'll stop your heart. And then after your heart has been stopped for 5 to 7 minutes, we'll shock you again, and your heart will start again, and hopefully it'll be in sync this time. So I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, "You're going to kill me." He goes, no, we don't like to look at it that way, okay? And it's a controlled environment. You'll be in the hospital. I'm going to be with you. I'll be with you the whole time. And by the way, there's going to be an anesthesiologist, and before the procedure, he's going to give you something that's going to make you comfortable. So I go from, "You're going to kill me," to, "I'm going to get comfortable." Now, it's not that I haven't been comfortable in AA, but I haven't been that kind of comfortable in over 20 years, right? And this is a free pass. I know my sponsor will be okay with it. So I'm okay, man, book me up, doc. Let's do the procedure. Let's get this on schedule. Let's go, baby. And so we schedule it. I show up to the hospital. I got the little funky gown on. They tape it up on me. They put an IV in me, and I'm talking to Dr. Carlson. The anesthesiologist walks in. He's got a syringe full of Comfortable. And I'm watching him the whole way around. He asks me how I'm doing. I tell him I'm doing good. I'm ready to get comfortable. Let's go. Let's go. So he injects this thing in the IV. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to Dr. Carlson. And Dr. Carlson says, how you doing? I said, I'm good. Let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and do it. He goes, no. We already did it. The procedure worked. I'm like, no, that ain't right. You told me I was going to get comfortable. I mean, this is unacceptable, because I'm thinking I'm going to get comfortable. Now, he's like, it worked. I'm arguing with him, because I have that moment where I want to get comfortable again. That's alcoholism. Okay, that's alcoholism. Now, the weird thing about this story, though, is when I got shot, I was on an AA retreat. It gets better. I was leading the retreat. I'd given a talk the night before on unity, and that evening, before I was shot, which curtailed events a lot, I was going to give a talk on forgiveness and acceptance. I mean, you can't make this up. But the best part of the whole thing is the guy that shot me, I sponsor him. Yeah. Yeah, I sponsored him then. I sponsor him now. He screwed up. And one of the things that's my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I screwed up before I got sober, and I've screwed up since. You know, this was kind of a big one, but I love the guy. You know, he messed up. He didn't try to kill me. At least I don't think he tried to kill me. And that's the nature of it. Now, by the way, Ricky, being new with 4 days, that's not only not required, it's not suggested. I'm sure if you talk to your sponsor, he'll tell you no handguns, certainly not above him or anything. But I'm really glad to be here because of that. And I got here on July 27th, 1996. That's my sobriety date. I came on I got a court card. I got a DUI. I got a DUI down in Orange County, and I went to court, and the judge sentenced me to go to 6 AA meetings in 6 months. Whew. I thought that was unreasonable. You know, that was just untenable. I couldn't even imagine doing 6 AA meetings in 6 months. And I waited a period of time, and I had about 5 weeks left to do 6 AA meetings. And in my mind, I'm thinking, who could possibly do that? That's more than one a week. Because I have a busy schedule. I suffer from a delusion because I'm alcoholic, so I think I got a lot of stuff going on. I don't have anything going on, but I think I do. And I finally went to my first AA meeting, and I got to tell you, I hated it. I hated it. I hated you. I hated the whole concept. I look at the steps. You know, and I thought, that's ridiculous. It has nothing to do with my discrete set of specific issues and problems. And I've been around a while, and I got to tell you, I've never seen anybody come into AA and look at the 12 steps up on the wall and go, oh, thank God, I've been waiting my whole life for this. You know, Dale, will you please take me through the steps? That's not how we do it. You know, the book talks about being beaten into a state of reasonableness. You know, driven under the lash of alcoholism. And, you know, this is my experience. I got to tell you, the third tradition is the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. Before the second edition came out of the big book, before the traditions, it used to be the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. Then we kind of wised up after a while and realized that that might be a little bit hard on the newcomer. So you can don't even have to be honest. You can lie to us, okay? But that's the only requirement. You don't have to go to meetings even. You certainly don't have to do the steps. And what happened to me was I'm at meetings, and I'm thinking I'm going to get sober. I am physically sober, but I don't know anything about sobriety. I don't know anything about being comfortable. And I'm thinking, you know, there's these older women in the meetings that I'm going to that are saying, you know, honey, just don't leave before the miracle. I'm like, okay, I'm ready for the miracle. Give me the miracle. I'm ready. Give it to you. I'm not going to do anything. I'm here. Give me the miracle. It didn't come. You know, I had a lot of activity and no action. You know, and the action is the program. It's the 12 steps. It's what is the basis for the program of recovery. And there's people I know that just go to meetings and they seem to be fine. I'm not that guy, you know. I'm not an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't appointed. I wasn't anointed. I'm just the drunk that's up here that's got some period of sobriety that's talking about his experience, my experience. You're here to have your experience. But I went about 100 days and I'm stark raving sober. I am out of my mind. I mean, I'm going to 2, 3, 4 meetings a day, because people have said meetings, meeting makers make it, 90 meetings in 90 days. So I'm going to 3, 4, sometimes 5 meetings a day, and I'm not getting it. And what's happening is people are talking about being restored to sanity, and I feel like I'm going nuts. I mean, I'm a jackass at home, I'm a jackass at work, I'm a jackass at meetings. I come into the meetings and the old timers go, "Lamb, just sit in the corner and for God's sakes don't talk to any newcomers because they still have hope." You know, it was bad. You know? And people are sharing and I'm hearing white noise. I can't focus and I'm scared. I'm a trial lawyer by trade, so I went to go do some depositions back east before a trial. And I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I was supposed to be there through the end of the week, but I was done, I don't know, Wednesday, Thursday, maybe midday. And I go back to my hotel room. And inside the hotel room, I've got an honor bar. An honor bar. I mean, I'm a newcomer. I have no honor, but they've given me this little mini fridge, and I've got the key to it. And it doesn't have everything I want and need in it, but it's a really good start. You know, 2 by 2 by 2 by 2, you know, vodka, gin. There's whiskey in there. There was no tequila, which kind of irritated me, but there's beer, domestics, imports, you know, all, and then water and a bunch of other crap. But, you know, there's the stuff. It's in there. And I want a drink. I want a drink. I haven't had a spiritual experience. I haven't had a psychic change. I haven't worked a step. I don't have a sponsor. I don't have a God in my understanding. And I'm feeling separate and apart, which is what every alcoholic I have ever talked with feels. The 12 and 12 calls it anxious apartness. It's the grand illusion. It's the big delusion. It's not true. But for me, I can't see that until I've worked through the steps. I love the big book. I love the 12 and 12. But one of my favorite things when I was new, my sponsor Michael had me listen to a series of talks by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. The old timers know this guy. In 1975, he gave a series of talks in Palo Mesa, California. One of his sponsees eventually put it in a book form. It's called A New Pair of Glasses. And I listened to those talks, and I read that book. And in the book, Chuck has a drawing. It's a really simple drawing. There's only one drawing in the whole book. He draws a circle. And inside the circle, Chuck puts all the people, plants, and animals in the universe inside the circle of life. Then he puts life, good, God, whatever your concept of a higher power is, inside the circle of life. And then to the side of the circle of life, he draws a stick man. And that's Chuck, and that's me. And if you're an alcoholic of my variety and you haven't worked the steps, I suspect that's you. And what separates us is a thin line that he calls ego, or conscious separation from God. In the 11th step, we're striving for conscious contact, but I'm new, I haven't worked a lick of steps, I have conscious separation. So I'm trying to distract myself. First thing I do is I open and shut the honor bar a number of times. Then I open it up and I inventory it. You know, I arrange it, domestics to imports to get ready. Now I'm getting really nervous because I know I can't drink. I'm the kind of guy that my wife sends me out to get milk and I come back 3 days later. You know, that's what I do. I drink beer, I shoot tequila, I talk to people, things happen, I black out, I time travel. I come back 3 days later, I have the milk. I got the milk. She's not impressed, right? So I'm nervous, so I'm trying to distract myself. I'm watching television. I'm flipping back and forth between religious television and porno. Religious television and porno. And you too, huh, sir? Yeah, it's a... Now the bad thing is I'm getting confused as to who's doing what on what station. But that's... I found that's a personal problem. It doesn't have anything to do with alcoholism. And then what happens is I don't drink. I don't know if it's the dumb luck of the alcoholic. Norm Alpe used to call it seconds and inches. I now believe it's the grace of God, but I would not have called it that then. I go downstairs, I get in the car, I got all my stuff, I go to the airport, I fly home. I get home, I get up in the next morning, and I've got a plan. Because I'm a newcomer, and I've been thinking on the whole plane ride. Okay? And like I said, I was in the Army for 13 and a half years. I went in 1980, got out in 1993. I went through infantry school, airborne school, ranger school. I went through special forces training. I served as a Green Beret in Beirut in 1983. You know, after I did that for a few years, I was in Northern Africa. They sent me to law school at USC. And then I spent the last 6 years and some change as a JAG. And my last job in the Army was I was the intelligence oversight advisor to the Department of the Army. Now, that should scare you. okay? Because I was a flaming drunk. You know, I had blanket travel orders. I could go anywhere to look at any unit that was, we call a special mission unit or a classified unit. And I remember, you know, no one could question it. I didn't have to get approval. I remember one time I came back from a trip and somebody asked me, Manila, what were you doing in Manila? I'm like, hey, dude, I can't tell you that. That's classified, right? And then I'm walking away. I'm thinking, what was I doing in Manila? You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm sure it seemed like the thing to do at the time, right? And when I got out of the Army, I had a kit bag. We call it a go bag. I had some weapons, some demo, and I had 13 passports in it. And those passports had my photograph, different names, different countries. And I had used them for God and country for a while, and that and the weapons and the demo. When I left the Army, I didn't really think of it as stealing. I just thought, you know, this could come in handy one day, right, you know? So I got this stuff, and I pull it out from the closet. And by the way, I've gotten rid of all of it since then. And I'm not going to use the weapons or the demo, but I need the passports. Because my newcomer plan goes like this. I've got my blue tourist passport, my regular official passport that the government has given me to travel as a tourist. And I'm going to use that. I'm going to leave the country on my name. It's important to leave the country on your name. Then when I get up to British Columbia, I'm going to start heading east for a week or two, maybe go over to Europe for a little bit, and I'll start flipping passports and identities. And I'll get back to British Columbia, and Steve Lamb will cease to exist. Now, I have a wife. I have a kid. But this is really a career change, so I'm not really consulting them at all, right? This is just an independent action that I've decided that I'm going to take. And I lay all this stuff out, and I'm looking at it, I'm inventorying it, and the 13 passports that I should have turned in 1993 are all current. They have not expired. But my blue tourist passport has expired. I was devastated, because now I cannot execute this seemingly brilliant plan. Now, the pathetic, pathetic thing about this is, you know, I mean, I went to college. The Army sent me to law school. They sent me to get an LLM, you know, at the JAG school right next to the University of Virginia. I'm licensed to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. But this is 1996. I could have flown to British Columbia on my driver's license. This is before 9/11. I didn't need a passport to go to Canada. But I did not have the synaptic capacity to realize that. I was just so... My New York friends, you know, call it, you know, MOCUS, mind out of focus. You know, I'm just new. I just can't even think straight. And I'm sitting there. I'm almost in tears. And the only thing I could think of doing was going to a meeting. So I went to a meeting that morning, and there was a guy named Jim Nisbet. He died with 15 years of sobriety. He became my grand sponsor. But I didn't know that at the time, and I did not like Jim. Did not like Jim at all. All Jim talked about was God, the big book, the steps, you know, sponsorship in no particular order. That's all he talked about every time. And I wasn't doing any of that stuff. And that morning he was talking about sponsorship. And I learned later this isn't exactly what he said, but what I heard was, if you don't have a sponsor, see me after the meeting. I'll help you get a sponsor. And I'd heard people say, you know, find someone that has what you want. So I'm thinking there's going to be an interview process. And I go up to Jim and I say, okay, Jim, I looked at him in the shoes because I couldn't look at him in the face. And I said, Jim, I've been around about 100 days, and I think it's time that I interview for a sponsor. And he grabbed me by the shoulder. He said, man, you are pathetic. And he took me outside, and he introduced me to a guy named Michael. I'd never met Michael before. He says, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsee, go with God. And he walks away laughing. And I'm thinking, well, this ain't funny. It's not even slightly amusing. I don't even know this guy, right? And Michael... You know, he's got a new guy's been delivered to him. So he's excited. He reaches in his pocket. He gets a piece of paper. He writes his name and his address on it. And he asks me a couple questions that I like to ask the people I sponsor. He says, do you have a big book? Now I'm looking at this guy. And I'm not saying this, but I'm thinking, yeah, man, I had a big book. I'm not reading it with you, though. This is just ridiculous. I mean, I don't even know this guy. But I said, yeah, I got a big book. He says, do you have a 12-12? And again, I'm looking, I'm not saying this, but I'm like, I got a 12-12, what does that have to do with it? By the way, he's got this lazy, wandering eye, okay? It's like, doesn't even focus on you, just shifts off to the right, you know? And I said, I got a 12-12. He goes, good, you're going to need them both. Be at my house Monday night at 6:30. And every bone in my body said no, but I heard myself say, okay. And as soon as I said okay, he turned around and walked away, because he knew what he was dealing with. He didn't want to give me time to reconsider. And I, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had accepted the first half of the first step, that I'm powerless over alcohol, but not that my life is unmanageable, not until I asked that man, even in the lame way that I did, to sponsor me. So I meet with him the first Monday night. He tells me a little bit about himself. I tell him a little bit about myself, what's been going on. He gives me directions. We're going to read the book. We're going to read the 12 and 12. We're going to start at the beginning. I have to read, and then I have to show up like homework, and then we're going to go over the reading, and he's going to ask me a bunch of questions. He's going to put things in first person rather than the we or you so that I identify. He's going to ask me questions about whether I agree or disagree or whether I've had that experience or not. When we get to a prayer, we say the prayer. When we get to a step, we work the step. And I remember thinking, this is ridiculous. And if you're new, I'm telling you that this saved my life. This saved my life. My experience in AA is attitude is optional. I had a totally crappy attitude, but I was desperate and I did it. And if you do the work will do you. And what it requires, generally speaking, from my experience, is a certain level of desperation, which feels like it really sucks because it does. That's the price of admission. That's what you paid to get in the rooms. But that desperation is the gateway to grace. That can unlock a world that you cannot even conceive of or imagine. So, you know, we go through this process, and, you know, by the way, I show up to, and I'm, you know, he doesn't trust me. I have to read to him. You know, he thinks I don't know the meaning of words, which apparently I didn't. I have to look them up in a dictionary. It was humiliating. You know, I'm a lawyer. I got an LLM, for God's sakes. He didn't care. Because he was more concerned about my recovery than my feelings. And we went through this process, and I remember thinking it was tedious and it wasn't working because we can't often see it in ourselves. And I remember we got to the second step. You know, it talks about being restored to sanity. It talks about a power greater than, I've read ahead, I know the power. We're talking about God. I'm not okay with that. And Michael's like, well, what's the problem with God? I said, well, it's not that I don't necessarily believe in God, but, you know, I did a lot of bad things out there. And, you know, people have been saying to me, like, you know, find God or die. And I'm thinking, I not only don't want to find God, I'm really kind of hoping he doesn't find me. I've read ahead. There's a ninth step. This isn't going to go well. And he says, well, maybe your concept of God is wrong. I said, well, that's possible. And he told me a lot of things that were really helpful to me, you know, to try to get me interested. And he told me, like, you'll see the word God over 100 times in the big book. You see higher power, creative intelligence, universal mind. At one point in time on page 13, Bill refers to God as my newfound friend, capital F. Who doesn't want a friend? I'm thinking, yeah, okay, but he's just trying to trick me, right? And because I'm not really buying it. And he goes, well, look, in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you've got a religious or spiritual practice, we encourage you to keep doing it. In fact, to go further, the book talks about be quick to see where religious people are right. There are many books, so you could, priests, rabbis, everything. Do that. But if you have a problem with drinking, we're going to suggest you lay the steps over the top of that and work the steps. And if you have a problem with God or you don't have a concept of God, why don't you look at it as a placeholder for an experience you haven't had yet? Just think of it as a word. Can you do that? Maybe. So then we get to step three, and I got to turn my will and my life over to this placeholder that I haven't had an experience with yet. And he says, well, look, you'll get that experience through working the steps. And I'm still kind of hesitating, and then he takes me to page 37 in the 12 and 12. And on page 37, there's something called the acid test. And the acid test is pretty simple. It goes something like this. How is what you're doing working for you? I'm like, well, not very well, Michael. I'm sitting here talking to you, obviously, right? And he goes, well, look, are you willing to try it our way? And I was. Now, I'll tell you, later on in the 12 and 12 on page 88, when you're in the 10th step, it's the same test. So after you've worked 3 through 9 and you're in an active 10th step, the 12 and 12 asks you, how is what you're doing now working for you? And in every instance, it's always better. Because AA is practical. If it wasn't practical, if it didn't work, we wouldn't do it. We wouldn't do it. But I asked him, I said, well, how will I know if I've done a third step? You know, I mean, we read the prayer, did all that kind of stuff. I don't know that I felt anything. I've done it with other people. I've done it with, I don't know, lots of people, and they've had moments. I didn't have a moment. He goes, well, you know, a good general indication is, you know, if you're willing to start doing a fourth step. I mean, you're going to do a third step your whole life. You're going to be turning it over your whole life. But a good general indication of turning it over is, you know, taking that next step. You know, at once we commenced, we did this fourth step. So he takes me to page 65 in the big book. And if you're new, that's where the columns are. And he says to me, you notice anything about those columns, Lamb? I'm like, well, not really, no. He goes, well, look again. I'm like, well, Mr. Brown's kind of a jackass. Somebody ought to tighten him up. He goes, no. That's not what we're talking about, okay? He goes, you notice that they're not even complete sentences. In fact, they can be bullet points. And you really don't need more than maybe two or three words for each column. You need to identify the resentment, okay? So who you're resentful at, the person, the institution, or the principal. Second column is the cause, two or three words. Third column is the condition or how it affects you. Is it self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations? You can even use abbreviations, SPAPS, if you want to do that. It's not a problem, because I'm going to be prepared for a long talk. Then in the fourth column, and there's no fourth column, but if you look on page 67, it talks about turning back to our list. We're going to look at mistake, fault, and blame. And those are character defects. And he told me, he said, that's not my part. You're going to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over, my part. That's a perfectly good shorthand, but that's not what the book says. And the problem with that for some people is they think that they have to have a part in both the second column and the third column, in the condition and in the cause. And that's not the case. For example, some woman just got raped. She comes into Alcoholics Anonymous. She's got to do an inventory. She's resentful at the rapist. Okay. What's the cause? He raped me. You know, what does it affect? Probably pretty much everything. You know, now what's her part? What's her part in the cause? This is BS. I didn't have any part in the cause. I didn't invite that. We always have a part or a mistake, fault, and blame in one of the two columns, always in the condition, but not necessarily the cause. That's what he told me. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I'm trying to follow directions. He says, look, when you talk about mistake, fault, and blame, all you got to do is list selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, dishonesty, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth, what we call the seven deadly sins, and fear. That's it. It's one of those things. That's all you got to do. One word, okay? One word each. And then he gave me the fear inventory, and he gave me the sexual misconduct inventory, and he turned me loose. He said it should take me 2 or 3 weeks. It took me about 5 weeks. It took me about 2 or 3 weeks to think about it and 2 weeks to do it. Because the book says it's simple but not easy. The simple part is the black part, the instructions. The not easy part is me and my ego, which tries to separate me from you and from God. The first is possible, the second is impossible, but I don't realize that until I've gone through this process. So I come to him and I'm going to read a fifth step. Now, particularly for the people that are new, I'm going to tell you the first person on my fifth step. And while we share generally, I'm going to share this specifically because I want you to understand how simple this is. It is so simple. We make this such a big deal. People carry this around for months and months and months and months, and it's not necessary. Caveat, if that's what your sponsor tells you to do, I'm sure he's right. But my experience is I need to do this. I need to do this now. So, first person on my inventory. I'm resentful at, two words, my father. Second column, what's the cause? Two words, deserted me. Now, again, Michael's prepared for a long talk. I tell him that, you know, I was 4 or 5 years old. My father was in the Air Force. He left. He went to Vietnam. He didn't come back. He didn't die there. He just didn't come back. You know, he stayed there for 2 or 3 tours. I'm not exactly sure. He joined an outfit called Air America. And then when he was with Air America, he did a number of other tours there. He was over there, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 years maybe. He met a Thai woman, Lian Thong, my stepmom, married her before he divorced my mom. I have a half-sister, Peck. I've never met either of them, and I hardly hear from my father. I hear from, you know, I don't know, maybe a card or a letter every 5 to 10 years. I think I got a phone call once. That's about it. What does it affect? What is the condition? Everything. Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. You know, as my former grand sponsor, Scott Redmond, used to say, it was a five-bagger. It was a big one. Now, what's my mistake, fault, and blame? Was I selfish, self-centered, or self-seeking? I don't think so. Was it dishonesty? No. How about pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth? I wrote down anger. I was really angry as a little kid. Now it's just kind of a dull, throbbing resentment. I detest him. Seems to sound like anger. Then fear. I have a lot of fear. What am I afraid of? I love my father. And in my mind, I gave him a certain amount of power. And he abused that power, and it hurt me deeply. And because of that, the way I dealt with that is I had to have a wall of insulation between me and you and me, because it wasn't safe for me. Now, that was my protective insulation, but it does not make for good relations with the wife, with the kids, with coworkers, with friends. You know, when I got to the part in the big book that talks about the actor, I totally got the actor. I don't want to be me. And I don't want you to know who me is, because if you know who me is, you can hurt me. So I have a lot of fear. And then, as it says on the bottom of 66 and 67, I'm unwilling to accept that my father's a child of God who could be spiritually sick like me. I'm unwilling to forgive him. So I tell this to Michael, and I'm getting ready to go on to the next person, which, by the way, is my mother. And Michael stops me. I don't realize this is an interactive process, right? He goes, whoa, I got some questions. I'm like, well, what are they? He says, well, I want to make sure I understand this. So you resent your father, right? I said, well, yeah. He deserted you, right? Yes, yeah. And it affects everything, right? And I said, yeah, other than that, things are going pretty well. But yeah, it's a big one. And then he says, and you've got some residual anger, a lot of fear, and you don't want to forgive your father, right? I'm like, yeah, I've read ahead, Michael. I know there's a ninth step. It's not going to happen. And Michael looks at me and he says, look, this is a program of willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness, but we're just doing the fifth step now. But I got to tell you, we're going to get to that later, and I have one more question. I'm like, okay, what is it? He says, well, I want to make sure I understand this, because when you came to me in the first session that we had, I told you a bit about myself, and you told me a bit about yourself, and you told me what happened, you know, right before you came to me and asked me to sponsor you. And you had told me that you were going to basically take these passports, and you were planning on going to, I think you were going to go to Costa Rica, right? You're going to go to Costa Rica? I said, yeah, well, I had some former associates of mine that were doing some kind of interesting marketing and distribution at the time. I was going to go down and join them. And he goes, well, you weren't going to take your wife and your kids, right? I said, well, no, it had nothing to do with them. He said, well, you didn't say you were going to desert them, but is there functionally any difference between what you were planning on doing and what your father did? My first thought was, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all, okay? And I hung my head and I muttered something like, well, I mean, if you look at it that way. And if you're new, that's why in the fifth step we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, because I can't see me for who I am. I have delusions. I think things are real that aren't real. And I need to hold myself up to someone who can reflect me back to me, in this case, my sponsor. And, you know, we went through the rest of the inventory. I went through the fear inventory, the sexual misconduct inventory. I got home, I got quiet, like it says in the big book. I reviewed what I'd done. I thought I was fearless and thorough. I realized later when I start sponsoring men that I wasn't. One of the things I might talk about over the weekend is how certain things popped up that I didn't suppress or try to hide from my sponsor. I just forgot about them. And then, you know, we're amazingly similar. So these little boogers that I sponsor, they tell me stuff, and they're like, God, I did that, and I forgot about it. And I had to go deal with it later. And then I turn the page, I got to do 6 and 7, and 6 and 7 are really substantial, and there's a lot in the 12 and 12 on them. In the big book, there's very little on them, and I did it, honestly, I did it very superficially at first. They're a lot about willingness. You know, 6 is a lot about willingness, and 7 is a lot about humility. I had very little of either, but I'm scared to death, you know. I need to move forward. I feel like I'm in the middle of an ocean and I gotta swim. I don't see a shore, but you know, he's telling me it's that direction. I gotta either, you know, give up and die, and I'm not willing to do that, or swim. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just trying to take the next indicated step. And Michael says he wants to see an 8-step proposed list, my proposed amends. So I write it all out, and a week or two later, I show up and I show him the list. And Michael looks at the list. He goes, your father's not on the list. I'm like, I told you he wasn't going to be on the list. You know, what? Were you paying attention a couple weeks ago? I mean, he's not going to be on the list. He says, well, look, do you think you're any better than your father? And I said, no, and thanks for pointing that out to me, Michael. That's just really made my day. And he's trying to convince me. He says things like, you know, at the end of a lot of meetings, we say the Lord's Prayer. And there's a clause in the Lord's Prayer. It goes, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. He said, what do you think that means? Like, I think it's a damn trick question. That's what I think it means. Because it's a spiritual truth. It's a maxim. I'm only forgiven to the extent that I forgive. You know, we're here. There's a big statue of St. Francis out there. And, you know, on page 99 of the 12 and 12, we have the 11-step prayer, or what's the our version of the prayer of St. Francis. And one of the things it says it is through forgiving that we are forgiven. So I agree with all this stuff. I mean, it sounds good, but I'm not willing to do it. So Michael says, well, look, the 8th step has a lot to do about willingness. Are you willing to pray for the willingness? Okay, I'll do that. So he says, okay, you pray, I'll pray, we'll both pray. So I start doing 9 steps. I make amends to the wife. Back in the big bed, I don't quite have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve, but things are going better. You know, I pay back some of the money. I'm starting to get, you know, my relations with people are going well. I got an active 10-step progress program where I'm, you know, doing a review, and I do it at night, and I do it again in the morning. And if I need to make amends, I'm making amends promptly. Now, by the way, when I was new, promptly was about 3 weeks. That time frame is compressed over time. And I'm doing 11-step. I'm praying and meditating. Meditation is not extra credit. That's part of it. It doesn't say prayer or meditation. It says prayer and meditation. And I'm trying to get into contact with this thing that I don't really understand. And now I'm in the 12th step. I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs. And I'm trying to carry the message. And I got a little less than 2 years, and guys are coming to me, and I'm sponsoring them. And I'm taking them through the steps. And they're getting sober, and they're taking a year. And the first 5 guys I took through the steps, they all got a year. I thought, oh, you clearly have been waiting for me, you know, because I know how to do this and you don't. I had a little problem with spiritual pride. And I'll tell you, about 3 or 4 years into it, I couldn't get a guy through Bill's story for about a year. And I went to my sponsor and I said, man, I must be doing something wrong. And he laughed at me. He goes, Lamb, look, I was about 5 years sober when you came to me, and you're the first. The first what? The first one that got a year. You know, we're there for them, but we're there for us, okay? If they get sober, that's great, but all we can do is show them what we've done. If they want to do it, they do it, but there's not much we can do about it. And a lot of times they do, a lot of times they don't. That's under God's plan and their plan. You have nothing to do with that. You know, you're just a doorman, okay? So we're going through this process, and I got several years sober. You know, I'm taking people through the steps. I mean, I'm a man of God. Just ask me. I'll tell you. I'll tell you, it seems to me that around 4 or 5 years sobriety, this is what happened to me, and I've seen it with a lot of people. I really know stuff now. Whether you ask me or not, I'm going to tell you because I know what's worked. I'm on fire, man. I mean, I will tell you stuff. I remember there was a guy outside the meeting one time. One of the worst things I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous is this guy was carrying, he had a backpack with 3 or 4 3-ring binders full of his 4-step that he'd been working on for a year. Now, what's important to know is he did not ask me my opinion. Okay? I told him, unsolicited, that is completely unnecessary. It's a total waste of time. If you just go to page 65, if you do it the way it's outlined in the book, you'll stay sober. You're wasting your time. I got up and I walked into the meeting, and I got about halfway into the meeting, and I thought, you jackass. I mean, who are you to tell this guy what to do? And I went back and I told him, I said, look, I apologize. I had no business saying that. I believe that that's true, by the way. But it doesn't matter. Okay, he didn't ask me. And I apologized, and he was at the meeting, and I saw him, and I have never seen him since. I don't know if he's sober. I don't know if he's drunk. I don't know if he's alive. I don't know if he's dead. But I had no business doing that. He has a sponsor, and he has a God, and I am neither one of them. And I really did a lot of inventory about that. I tried to find that guy. I couldn't find that guy to try to make a further amends. I have no idea where he was. Or where he is. None. But I'm going through this process, and I'm not making amends to my father. I'm not. So I got, I don't know, 6, 7, maybe 8 years sobriety. And I tell my sponsor, Michael, well, I'm going to go up to Anchorage to do some depositions. And he goes, man, that's great. He's all excited. He goes, you'll make amends to your father. I'm like, whoa. I'm not. I had forgotten. I told him that my father was living in Wasilla, Alaska, which is about 30 miles outside of Anchorage. He goes, great, you'll make amends to your father. I go, no. He goes, no, you've been praying, I've been praying. Or you've been praying, right? I said, yeah. He says, well, God's talking. Can't you hear him? I'm like, no, I don't hear that at all. I'm not getting the memo. He goes, look, you're getting quiet, you're meditating every morning, just spend the next week and think about that, you know, contemplate on that. And I did, and that was the answer. Okay, so I'm going to do it. But then I asked Michael, I said, well, what do I say? What do I do? He goes, I don't know. I'm not going up there. Talk to God. I'm like, oh, man. So I call my father. He says he'll meet me, and I fly up to Anchorage. I don't know what to do. I go through the airport. I'm in the terminal. I see my father, and he's a lot older and shorter than I remembered, and he's just shuffling towards me. He's uncertain. I am striding towards him with purpose. I have no idea what I'm going to do. But when I got up to my father, I did one of the things that I really hated all the physical contact when I first got here, all the hand-holding crap. I did just, good Lord, you know, huggy, huggy, kiss, kiss, you know, oh, man. And I grabbed my father, whom I hadn't seen, geez, decades. And I hugged him to my shoulder, and he buried his head in my shoulder, and he cried. And I cried, and forgiveness occurred. And all I had to do was show up and get out of the way. And if you're new and that doesn't make any sense to you, it's because you haven't done this yet. Because a lot of this doesn't make any sense looking forward. It only makes sense looking backwards. And I go back and, you know, I get relationships with my wife and kids are better. Everything's better. Everything's better. You know, and I got to tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. But just to give you an idea, I don't like to spend a lot of time on the drunkalogue, but for the new people, just so you understand who you're dealing with, okay? This is what it was like right before I got sober. Again, I'm a trial lawyer by trade, so I have to prepare for trial. The way I prepare for trial is I drink beer and I shoot tequila. I take the case file out and I put it on the kitchen table or the conference room table. I don't open it. I don't open it. I don't disturb it at all. I just set it there, and I start drinking beer and shooting tequila. The beer is like a basic food group, and the tequila is an accelerant, okay? I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila, and what happens is, in my mind's eye, I'm in the courtroom, and I pick a jury, and then I make an opening statement, which is a really good opening statement, and then I examine and I cross-examine witnesses. All the evidence I want to get in, I get in. All the evidence I need to exclude, I exclude. I make a closing argument, which is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. The jury retires, they deliberate for a while, they come back and they render a verdict or a judgment in my favor. All this through drinking beer and shoot tequila. Now, the problem with this process is the way I drink beer and shoot tequila, I drink until I pass out. So sometime around the jury retiring to deliberate, I go down. And I know this is going to happen, so I set 4 or 5 alarm clocks at 3 to 5 minute intervals all around the room. Because 1 or 2 probably is not going to wake me up. The next morning, the 4th or 5th alarm clock goes off. I get up, I stagger around. I'm drunk. I'm not like I was the night before, but I'm still drunk. I shower, I shave, I put on a suit and tie, and I go to court. And this particular morning that I'm thinking about, I'm going to court, Los Angeles Superior Court, you know, right down on Hill Street. I got a client, his name is Brian, he's a high finance guy from New York. The case is about other people's money. We're the plaintiff, and we're dealing with this case, and we're trying to settle it, but we haven't been able to settle it, and the judge says to us, he says, look, you've been through a mediation settlement conference, and this is just about money, so while the lawyers are picking a jury, I would really like the two clients to try and keep talking and see if you can come to a resolution, because you're going to tie my courtroom up for 3, 4, maybe 5 weeks. So they go about doing that, and we're picking a jury. Around 11:30, Brian comes to me, and he's really excited because he's got a settlement. And it's several million dollars in his favor. He tells the judge is happy, the judge puts it on the record, and he releases us. And Brian looks at me, it's a little before noon, he says, God, man, this is great. I thought I was going to be out here for weeks, this is great. I know it's early, it's before noon, but it seems like we should celebrate. Do you want to go have a drink? I'm like, what a country. I totally want to have a drink. Let's go, right? So he takes me to the Grand Avenue Bar. The Grand Avenue Bar is on Grand and Fifth. It's adjacent to or part of the Biltmore Hotel. It's kind of a high-end bar. Now, I drink alone a lot, and I'll drink in bars, but the bars I go to usually have a little sawdust on the floor and kind of this, I don't know, faint eau de urine scent that just stimulates me to drink tequila. This bartender, he's in a jacket and a tie, and, you know, it's a nice bar. And we walk in there, and Brian has him get a dusty bottle of cognac down from the back of the bar, and he puts it on the bar counter, and he takes out 2 large brandy snifters. And he pours a shot into each brandy snifter. And I'm watching. Now, when you pour a shot of tequila in a shot glass, you can see it. You know, you see it go in. You see it while it's in there. If he's a good bartender, you got to lean over and, you know, because you don't want to spill any of the nectar of the gods. But when you put one fluid ounce in a brandy snifter, you see it go in there. But it's kind of sad and lonely and desperate. You know, it's kind of got this amber glow and it shimmers. But I'm looking because it just seems like it's not much in there, right? And Brian says, "You've never had cognac before." I'm like, "No, I'm not." I mean, he's buying. I'm drinking. I'm not stupid. Because look, pay attention. There's a whole process. There's a protocol to this. And what you want to do is you want to take the brandy snifter and you want to put it in the base of the palm of your hand. And you want to twirl that cognac around so it coats the glass and the heat from the palm of your hand goes through the glass and warms up the cognac. You know, because that'll release the bouquet. Then you want to bring it up to your nose. You don't want to snort it. You don't want to sniff it. You just want to allow the bouquet to waft into your nostrils. And I'm sitting there thinking, good Lord, we're going to drink this, aren't we? You know what I mean? It's like, then you want to back it down, and once you've really appreciated the bouquet, you want to bring it up to your lips. You don't want to drink it. You don't want to sip it. You just want to allow that cognac to drape across your palate. So by now, I'm just kind of rocking back and forth slightly, right? My eyes twitching, and my teeth are itchy. You know, like you really need that drink, and you can smell it, but, you know, you can't get it, like, right away, and teeth are kind of itchy. And Brian says, pay attention. And he goes through the whole process. This guy's, like, right out of GQ. I mean, he's very graceful. He's very elegant. And, you know, he puts it down, and he looks at me. He goes, it's your turn. It's my turn. My turn. I love my turn. It's my turn. It's my turn, right? So I got this thing. I'm twirling around thinking, right, you know what? How warm does it need to be, right? You know? So I bring it up because I'm you know, maybe I'm going to take a little nose hit, but I'm not, you know, and bam, I shoot it just like tequila. You know, it's gone. No thought process involved. It's gone, right? And Brian looks at me. I look at Brian. I don't know who is more surprised, right? I'm like, you know, I just reverted to the alcoholic anthem. I said, man, I'm sorry, you know? And he goes, wow. But he's a gracious guy. You know, can I have a beer? He goes, yeah. So he buys me 3 or 4 beers. And, you know, I'm drinking beer, and he's taking forever with his cognac, right? So then he finishes. He says, okay, we'll have another. Pay attention. He goes through the whole process again. I'm like, I got it. Bam, it's gone again, right? Now he looks at me. He gives me that look like, hey, man, that ain't right, you know? And he's never read the big book, but he knows that I am bodily and mentally different than he is. And he's shaking his head. He's like, good Lord. Look, it's about 1 o'clock. I'm going to go to the bathroom, and then I'm going to come back, finish my cognac, and go back to the hotel and call New York. It's around 4 o'clock there. Tell him the good news. All right, fine. So I'm sitting there drinking my beer, minding my own business. He's in the bathroom. I look over, and I see his cognac. It had to be done, right? Bam, I drink that, right? I go to the bathroom. I come out. Brian is arguing with a bartender because someone has stolen his cognac, and, you know, it's pretty expensive, and I remind him that I'm a trial attorney. I cross-examine for a living. I'm going around. I'm cross-examining Rick. I mean, look at that face. You know he'd do it, right? You know, I mean, you know, but Brian is not stupid. Brian is what we now call an ex-client. And he's walking out of the bar. Now, I'm working for a large international law firm at the time. This is bad. I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to have some explaining to do. This is not going to go well. This is a major client. But I'm an alcoholic, and I'm thinking, great, now I'm going to drink the way I want to drink. So I get a table. I start drinking beer and shooting tequila. Forget that cognac stuff. It's too complicated. Beer and tequila. Drinking beer, shooting tequila. A lot of people, when they drink, they forget to do certain things like eat. That's not my problem. I like a light snack, maybe a couple cheeseburgers or a pizza, nothing big, right? And I eat this, and I'm drinking beer and shooting tequila, and I've had this, you know, light snack, and I start. I mean, it's going to sound disgusting because it is, but it's my only skill set. When I'm wasted, I just start farting. I'm just barking them off. You know, I'm just ripping farts like crazy, and people are looking at me like I'm nuts, and I'm having a good time. I got a whole symphony going on. I got this whole purple haze thing going on. There's two women over here, and they're looking at me, probably with disgust, because I have delusion. I'm looking at them going, yeah. They want me. Who wouldn't want this, right? You know? And I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. I'm barking them off. I go to lift my leg to be particularly melodious, and I completely miscalculate. It's happened to you too, huh, sir? Yeah. Now, the bad thing is it's happened to me before. You know, it'll kind of snap you back to sober almost. And you got to act cool, and don't act like anything's going on. And keep that leg cocked. Don't make contact with the seat, you know. And then you just kind of slide off on one cheek. You know, you slide off on one cheek, and I go into the bathroom. I take off my jacket. I take off my pants. I take off my drawers. I clean myself up. I put my pants back on. I put my jacket back on. I'm out at the sink. I'm rinsing my drawers out, right? I mean, you know, just like, you know, anybody would do, right? And, yeah, a guy walked in and looked at me just like that. Just Tom, just, ugh, you know, and I'm like, hey, what's your problem? You don't practice hygiene, right? So I get him wrung out. I go back in the stall. I take my jacket off, take my pants off, put my damp drawers on. Hey, I got some class. Put my pants back on, and I put the jacket on. I walk out, and I'm thinking, well, that went pretty well. Yeah, you know? And then I'm thinking, well, I'm feeling kind of sexy. Who knows what could happen? You know, I got damp drawers on, right? Because I got a delusion, right? And then finally, I get kicked out of the bar. I drive home. I park in the driveway. My driveway, your driveway. I'm an equal opportunity driveway kind of guy. I don't care, right? And I go through the door. The door is not the door with a key. That's not going to happen. I can't get a key in a keyhole. I go through the double door. I don't park there. I just open it because that's the only thing I can get in. You know, double door garage. I go in there. And then there's three steps that go up from the garage floor up to the living room. And right next to it, there's a fridge. And in the fridge, there's beer. And I don't care if I've been out for 3 hours or 3 days, I get a beer. I drink no matter what. That's what I do. I pop that thing. I'm drinking beer on the way up the stairs. I finish it. I put it on the nightstand. Maybe it hits the floor. I crawl into bed. 2 or 3 hours later, on a good day, I get up. I walk around. I stagger around. Maybe I go in my wife's closet, pee in her boots or trash can or something like that. And on a bad night, I wet the bed. That's what I do. I'm a vision for you when I get here, you know. And that was not enough to make me come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my drinking alone did not convince me. What convinced me was when I stopped drinking and what happened. Because it didn't get better. It got worse. Way, way worse. And the only relief that I got was through the steps. That's the only relief that I got. And I got to tell you, if you're new, I like to think of Alcoholics Anonymous really as kind of God's amusement park. And you all have paid the price of admission to the amusement park. You're here. And nobody asked you if you wanted to pay the price of admission. You have alcoholism. So alcoholism reached up in your soul and they took the price. And it's a steep price, but you're here. And you can stay in the park. You can go to meetings, not go to meetings. You can go to retreats, not go to retreats. You can do the steps, not do the steps. You can leave the park. But if you leave the park, there's no in and out privileges. There are none. You're going to have to pay another price. And you may not be able to foot that bill. There's a lot of our brothers and sisters that have left the park and couldn't get back. So we encourage you to stay in the park. Now, having said that, if you look around the park, you'll notice that there's 12 rides in the park, and we call them steps. And there's usually some old farts next to the rides, and they've been on the rides, and all they're doing, they're sitting there going, hey, man, come on, take the ride. Take the ride. You don't have to take the ride. But if you take the ride with that person, we call that person a sponsor, he'll show the high spots and the low spots. He'll tell you when to throw your hands up in the air and yell and shout and have a great time, and he'll also tell you when to duck and cover based on his experience. And eventually, after you've gone through the rides, all you're going to want to do is take the next person on the ride. So if you're here and you haven't done the steps yet, I hope you take the ride. Thanks for having me here.